So the crisis that destroys the socioeconomic cycle, the first one, is that these rich aristocratic idiots... Okay, the news is not bright today when you turn the TV on. Crime has risen in America the last few years after falling since the early 1990s. I don't really have to explain to people that America is in trouble. And if you think America's okay, you're probably rich or really fucking stupid. So, sorry, coming on a little strong. Chill out here for a second. But yeah, the country is in trouble, okay? Inequality is up to levels not seen since the Gilded Age, the 1890s. It's when the robber barons were a thing, and they are how they sound. And Americans' median absolute buying power is dropping as well. People are making more money, but inflation is 8%, and they're not making 8% more money. Does all of this just mean that we're just done? Are we going to fall to some greater power like China or Russia? Probably not Russia. They're way weaker than people say they are. Don't come for me, Putin. I'm sorry. Or are we just going to collapse in like an authoritarian revolution that turns the good old-fashioned, legalized authoritarianism that they have into something more akin to fascism? And that is a possibility, to be honest. I'm not going to tell you that's not going to happen. So what is our own history in America? Cycles of change. And cycles of change tell us about what the future may bring and what other historical examples do we have to point to that we can compare our current situation to. I'm Sam, and this is the Illegitimate Scholar Podcast, the weekly cultural anthropology and history podcast that tries to make sense of our senseless world through indigenous and historical examples, academic methods, and social science, and a perspective not limited by the crushing restrictions that come with traditional academia and public schools. That's obviously a new intro again, and like, I don't like reading off of this thing. I think it's I'm not really that great at being concise, which is why I take such long notes. You know, I like this. I like what I'm saying here. It just doesn't feel as me, but I need to like say something so people that are new to the show know like what it is. And, hopefully that was enough for you to bear with me, but I'm gonna continue working on my intro. I would really appreciate some feedback on that. If you hit me up on Twitter at ill_scholar, that's the easiest way to do it. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about our main question is, what do cycles of crisis, order, and reform show what the future will bring in America? And that mostly comes from a quote from the book that I'm going to be mostly referencing today, which is George Friedman's book, The Storm Before the Calm. So I'm going to briefly talk about a few ideas in his book. I mean, most of this episode is going to be talking about the ideas in his book. He identified two cycles, a political cycle that lasts for 80 years, and this is an institutional cycle, and a socioeconomic cycle that lasts 50 years, when the socioeconomics, which is the economy and socially, so it's like culturally, how they change over that time period. So he thinks that there's a new one every 50 years and of the socioeconomics, and there's a new institutional cycle every 80 years. Times he identifies are very convincing. So I'm going to start by briefly going over what the historic cycles are. We're going to talk about the historic cycles. And then next week, I'm going to go into way more detail in what the cycles that we're in right now are, and then what that means. But for this week, we're going to talk about the historic cycles in the U.S., both socioeconomic. After we go over the historic ones, next week we're going to go over the cycles that we're currently in, both in institutional and in socioeconomic, that we currently are in the United States. And then after that, again, next week, we're going to talk about some other examples of periods of reform and collapse and great change that throughout history that we can point to make a comparison. But as a whole, I really recommend you read the book. I'm going to be glossing over them. If they sound interesting to you, I'm going to put the link in the description. Please go and buy the book there, or buy the book anywhere. I'm going to link to Amazon for Audible and for just physical Amazon books, and you can get the book for free on Audible through trial. But even if you just get it from a library or another bookstore, please read it. It's an amazing book. History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. That's what people say, and I tend to agree with them, since history is humans and human nature has stayed generally the same. The human DNA has stayed generally the same. Modern humans have been around for 300,000 years, and yet, 2,000 years ago, people acted totally differently than they do today, and that is due to culture and people's responses to environment. That's essentially what this entire podcast is about. That's probably better than the intro. I mean, this entire podcast is about analyzing the modern world, especially America, through using examples throughout history where humans acted totally crazy to how we'd view it today. And yet somehow they did it. And it must have been because of their environment. And that is what culture responds to, both human and physical environment. So every civilization and government changes over time. You know, the Roman kingdom gave way to the Republic. The Republic gave way to the empire. The empire split into four empires. That four empires turned into two. Well, they weren't really four empires at the time. You know, Rome split up into four sections by co-leaders. But once again, I digress. Okay, so the current United Kingdom was born out of an empire, which had transitioned from a very large kingdom, which itself had manifested after centuries of consolidation with smaller kingdoms. And before that, there were tribes and chiefdoms, and the Romans had come in. And, you know, all of this is to say that over time, as the situation changes, as, you know, you have different invaders, you have different technologies that are created, the situation and thus the political organization and the economy of a place changes. And culture responds to that change, and that's how we have it. That's how culture changes over time. So the American government is no different. We obviously do not have the same government we had in 1787 when the Constitution was written. But that's the point. It's supposed to work over time, and you're supposed to be able to change it. That's why we have amendments to the Constitution. That's why it's legal. You can change it. You're not supposed to destroy it and write a new one like a lot of other countries do all the time. We just change ours, and we have methods for changing it. And those methods of how you're allowed to change it have changed as well. And all of that has to do with how the document was written and what it was meant to do. So the institutional periods that we're talking about in this and the socioeconomic periods, those are based specifically in the US. You know, you can't apply this 80-50-year cycle rule to other places. They might have their own that you can find. And honestly, it's probably a lot of coincidence and also trying to fit history in, but it, honestly, if you read the book, it's very convincing, and we're going to talk about it here. The strength of the institutions of a culture is not to remain unchanging, but to be malleable enough to bend but not break in the face of changing needs, technology, and physical as well as human geography. I read that like it was a quote, but I think I wrote that. What a dumbass I am. Okay. This is true of America as much as any other place. So we're going to talk about these institutional cycles, and we're going to talk about these socioeconomic cycles. In the first institutional cycle, it started with the Constitution in 1787, and it ended with the end of the Civil War. So it starts with the Constitution. This is a new thing. It's not perfect at the time. It ramps up. You know, there's like almost a golden age or something like that, or a good age at the very least. And then at the end, there's a crisis as it's the past form of government is no longer serving our needs. And that was definitely true in this case, because around 80 years after that, I think it's 78 years, is the end of the Civil War in 1865. And the crisis of the Civil War comes out of it kind of being up in the air whether states are allowed to leave. And this is a massive crisis, and all of them end in massive crises. This is socioeconomic as well as institutional. So the end of the Civil War, it ends with federal reform and a strengthening federal government. And it was needed to solve the crisis at the time. It was the best way they could do it. And I don't love it because I'm not a fan of federal power, but that's what happened. And it created new stability, and it propels the United States into this second institutional cycle. And the second institutional cycle, it starts slow, like all of them. They're building a new thing. They're building stability. And this was the Reconstruction era in the U.S. Like, this was kind of up in the air how it was going to go. You know, people were still holding on to Confederate money. Like, the South will rise again was very real back then. It's not real today, but it was real back then. And, you know, actually, I shouldn't say that. The idea that the South may actually rise again in the future when there is a destruction of the United States for some reason. I mean, America is not going to last forever, right? So nothing does. So yeah, the South might eventually rise again. Might not be in a Confederacy, but it could be the South in their own country or something. Yeah, New England could be a place. Cascadia, there's a thing. There's a flag for Cascadia trying to secede. So this second institutional cycle, 1865, starts ramping up later on. They fight the Spanish and the Mexicans. They start doing a lot of imperialism in the Philippines as well as the Caribbean. And it turns into a strong America into the turn of the century. But by the time World War II comes around, the old political institution, it was no longer serving what was created in 1945. So what always happens is, for some reason, the methods of that cycle that were created over the past 80 years for institutional or 50 for socioeconomic is they no longer serve the purpose that they were meant to. And George Friedman says this: the Great Depression rendered the second institutional cycle obsolete. The institutional rules that were in place did not solve the problem, and the problem had to be solved. World War II took the New Deal to its most extreme conclusion by intertwining the federal government in both the economy and the society. With both having essentially been nationalized during World War II, the older model was abandoned, and the foundation of a new institutional cycle was established and would remain in place for the next 80 years. So the old model was abandoned, 1945. This is kind of where the military-industrial complex comes from, essentially. This is, and that's a big part of the third institutional cycle. The military-industrial scientific complex is what I like to call it, because today it still includes a lot of scientific companies, and the Manhattan Project was kind of what popped this off, and that was all scientists who made the nukes. In this third institutional cycle, this is the current cycle that we're in, you know, 1945, we win. And unlike Russia and most of Europe, we are relatively unscathed, except for a few ships and the capital of Hawaii. And this is the current institutional cycle that we're in, and there are cracks that are starting to be seen. It doesn't come all at once. It builds up, and I think George Friedman's argument, which I agree with, is that this is ramping up because it does feel like our institutions are not serving our needs anymore. It's something I didn't write down, but that's very important, is in the second institutional cycle, what's very important in the third institutional cycle was a growing power of the president, because of the possibility of nuclear war, the president had to be able to get a gun, a nuke. He had to be able to launch the nukes. You got to make a split-second decision. Congress can't meet. Congress hasn't declared war since this happened. In the entire third institutional cycle, it's been always the president and the military-industrial complex, what some people might call the deep state. I mean, there are conspiracies about the deep state, sure, but the deep state exists. It's lobbyists and all these people that promote companies, and they promote their own special interests. Okay, and now we're going to talk about socioeconomic cycles. Socioeconomic cycle shifts about every 50 years. And these are the standards of the economy changing over time. What's assumed to be true in the economy changes during this time. Often a crisis when old methods stop working. There's often a crisis when the old methods stop working. This is just like with the institution, but it's applied to the economy. That will make more sense in a second. And the social makeup of the country through immigration and the class structure, and I'm including race in this, so class and racial structure, these change during this time. And at least they do in the United States. So what you'll see in these socioeconomic cycles is a changing of economic methods, as well as a changing of the immigrant, ethnic, and class structure of the U.S. And that's a pretty broad definition of class structure. But you start with the Washington cycle, and this was our revolution, right? So the American Revolution starts, but the American Revolution was started, unlike most revolutions, like the Russian Revolution or the French Revolution, which were revolutions of what the Marxists would call the proletariat. They were revolutions of ordinary people. Our American Revolution was led by our own aristocracy. So it was secession more than it was a rebellion. It's funny, we call the American Civil War the American Civil War when really it's a war of secession. And then we do the same thing with the American Revolution, because the American Revolution is a revolution, but the war itself was secession more than it was rebellion from the from common people, as is tradition in rebellions. But once again, I digress. So the Washington cycle. It starts with a revolution by the elites. These are elites like Washington, Quincy Adams, I'm sorry, just regular John Adams, Benjamin Franklin. These guys are Southern aristocrats and Northern businessmen, many of them coming from traditional aristocracy English families. And the economy it's a mercantile economy. There's a lot of trade between states, and that was a big part of the original Constitution, if you read through the whole thing. which is not that long, I recommend you do. This was trade between the states. And this was a big part of federal funding, was tariffs and of internationally and trade between the states. There was international trade as well, shipbuilding and finance. And the socioeconomics of the country, they don't really change after the revolution. There's not a revolution in the economy. They're still relatively doing the same thing. They would very quickly start trading with England again. It's really important that the economics of the colonies were not changed as it became the United States, because the institutional change that they had was absolutely radical. And it was a huge change to have that institutional change into this, into being ruled by a Congress that people hadn't really, they were referencing something from ancient Greece that people hadn't done for 1700 years. It's a long time. So, I mean, there were smaller examples of it, but nothing like this. It really was truly a insane thing for them to do. So the fact that the economics were stable while the political institution was being so wildly transformed, is pretty important. They needed to expand the country. So immigrants came and Western expansion began. So the socioeconomics of this era is that they are opening up to more immigrants as they break from the British Crown, and they can decide their own laws for immigration, which naturalization was part of what was in the Constitution at the beginning as well. And this was back when the federal government had very few things that they were doing. There wasn't a giant cabinet like there is today. There was only a few cabinet positions. So immigrants are coming, a lot of Scots-Irish. Some of them were already there. I think at this point, some immigrants from Germany start coming. So without going into too much detail about how this socioeconomic cycle ended, I'm going to tell you that Alexander Hamilton, my least favorite founding father, the guy who had that propaganda play done about him, Alexander Hamilton, he and his old money aristocratic friends, they created the first and the second national banks of the United States. And these were private banks that were apparently in the public interest, and they were meant to control the money supply and like keep everything stable. But instead, they really just served the people that ran it, because they were private banks. Why wouldn't they? So the crisis that destroys the socioeconomic cycle, the first one, is that these rich aristocratic idiots invested in Europe. And I don't know if George Washington meant investing in Europe when he warned about getting yourself entangled in European affairs, but that's what happened. There was a banking crisis when the Napoleonic Wars broke out, and that was the first of many times that Europe would just get us into a giant freaking mess. So they had to make some changes. What we haven't talked about yet, near the end of the socioeconomic cycle, there starts to be a crisis, and the old socioeconomic methods, they're trying to hang on. So John Quincy Adams, who is a pincushion for elite Cox and is one himself, he gets elected in 1824. And there's accusations of a stolen presidency. He beats Andrew Jackson. I think this was the one that was decided by the House of Representatives. It was a whole big thing, but it was like elite power trying to hang on in the Congress. So 1828, Andrew Jackson, also known as Old Long Knife, also known as the Indian Killer, also known as Old Hickory. He takes over 1829, and he two terms, goes until 1837. And at the beginning of the cycle, remember, it's ramping up. So 1828, that's when the Jackson cycle starts. It starts slow, of course. This is how it works. Starts slow, has to ramp up. And socioeconomically, the Jackson cycle is important because Jackson is the first president that is Scots-Irish. And the Scots-Irish were the original group that the native English, native to, you know, the United States, that was the first group that they didn't like. The first white group that they didn't like was the Scots-Irish. And Jackson is one of them. He had a poor background. These were people that were disenfranchised before, during, and after the American Revolution. Jackson was kind of weak in his first term, but second term, he had everything kind of politically held down, and they enact the gold and the silver standard. They were on the gold and silver standard, and changing this gold and silver standard was rough at first, like this was in the buildup, but then it leads to a lot of expansion and a lot of stability. So there's a small crisis. This is the crisis being fixed and things kind of settling in. And this allows expansion westward. This is what allows the financing for poor people to be able to go west, people like Andrew Jackson, people that are Scots-Irish. And it ends in 1876. And this was another contested election. This usually happens at the end of crises like this. This is when the Hays cycle starts. The Hays cycle, another part of the socioeconomic cycle, is the core technology. And this is going to become more important later. But the core technology of the Hays cycle is electricity and the internal combustion engine. And these inventions made things so much more efficient, and they were in a combination with a lot of other industrialization, that this begins the Industrial Revolution. So the Hays cycle, we have the Industrial Revolution, and they move from the gold standard and the silver standard together into just the gold standard. And I don't know why. Honestly, I don't know why. Some of the other things I could explain, this one, I don't know why, but this helped the economy as a whole, but increased inequality over time. But it created stability, and it allowed for industrialization to happen. Industrialization also comes rising inequality. This is the Gilded Age. And then comes to World War I. The end of World War I, Europe's destroyed. And this is important. It's important that Europe's destroyed. Usually I wouldn't care, but it affects America, so I'm concerned about it, okay? There's plenty of production, but there's not enough customers. This was all about building industry. And that industry was built, but they had no one to buy it. There was a lot of supply, no demand. So you need both of these things for an economy to flourish. So there's plenty of production. There's not enough customers. There's also low wages because they were accepting a lot more immigrants that were coming in. This was suppressing wages. If you disagree with that, we can argue about it. You can send me a letter, but supply and demand of labor works as well. Immigrants coming in, say whatever you want, but it does suppress wages. It does, because there's just more people to do the same amount of jobs, unless those people come with a net increase in demand, which they didn't at this time, and they often don't. Okay, so many immigrants here, socio-wise of socioeconomic, they're coming from Ireland, Southern and Eastern Europe. They are Jews, Catholics, and Blacks moving from the South to the North, okay? Which are not immigrants in the traditional sense, but as far as the Northerners were concerned, this was immigration. And this movement around the country changes the face of the country. The end of this cycle starts with it's bad inequality. It's after World War I. The KKK is the largest it's ever been. They don't like Black people. They don't like Jews. They don't like Catholics. There's also extremists on the left during this time. And this is when the Great Depression happens. And this leads us into the Roosevelt cycle. And the Roosevelt cycle begins with the New Deal. And regardless of what your politics are, the New Deal didn't work. You can say it did. I'm 95% sure it did not work. But the idea of intervention itself does work, and it works in the form of the GI Bill. And the GI Bill was very important. So a lot of veterans coming back from World War II, they use the GI Bill to afford houses. They go to college. There's a boom in housing. There's a boom in jobs. There's an increase in consumer credit, which is in stark contrast to the cycle before, when people could not get credit. They had low wages. There was a limit in the demand that people had. So the GI Bill and these other changes that happen after 1945, all this industry that props up, this is all part of the Roosevelt cycle. And the core of this cycle is the working class factory worker. And there's more demand at this time, which meets the needs that the supply during the Hays cycle was providing. And this cycle begins with the technology of management to increase production. And this is rather than like actual physical technological advance. This is like the science of management. The end of the Roosevelt cycle leads into the Reagan cycle. If you know, in 1980, I think he won 49 states. Reagan won. And this was a huge blowout win for red America, conservative America. This is the 1980s. This is the time when the fall of communism happens. America starts really winning. This is a very patriotic, very conservative time. And it created the economics of today. And this is one that I like to talk about a lot. I bet a lot of my listeners are fans of Reagan. I personally am not. I don't like him, and I will explain why next week. And this is Reagan's cycle. So what we're currently in is the end of the third institutional cycle, which started in 1945. And socioeconomically, we are at the end of the Reagan cycle. And for the first time ever, they're coming down at the same time. So this is new, and this has never happened in our history. Never before have the two cycles, institutional and socioeconomic, collapsed at the same time. So it's the time we're living in is interesting at the very least. Hope we're okay, you know. But George Friedman thinks that we're going to be fine on the other side. I think we're probably going to be fine too, but I think there's also the possibility of collapse. So next week, we're going to talk about what cycles we're currently in, what the end of those cycles mean, and what could come afterward. And we're going to talk about some examples from other places in history that had either reform or collapse in the face of needed change.